because it was emotional. I remember getting real, like, not on the air. That's funny. I didn't get emotional on the air, but when that sec, when the towers fell, I think I have PTSD from that, because it was like we were there and we were broadcasting it to the world. When the towers fell, I went, oh, God, I cannot believe that.
Run Your Life podcast with host Andy Vassily.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Run Your Life podcast. I'm host Andy Vassily. If you're a new listener today, thanks for taking a chance on my podcast. I really do appreciate it, and I sincerely hope you come back to listen to many future episodes. If you are a returning listener, as always, thanks so much for the support and for your time and energy. It's very much appreciated. I've said this many times before, but my podcast really is a passion project that I pay out of pocket for. So I really do appreciate the support. And the only thing that I ask is that if you find meaning or takeaway value in any episodes, that you do share them with people who you feel will benefit from listening. Today's episode is a very special one, as I had the chance to interview well-known Canadian sports broadcaster Rod Black. Growing up in Canada, I was very passionate about sport, in particular football and golf. So Rod's voice is very familiar to me over the years, going back to Canada on vacations, from living abroad, hearing Rod's voice and tuning into TSN was always such a treat for me. So being able to interview him today was an honor and a privilege that I have a lot of gratitude for. Rod is considered to be one of the greatest, most respected and beloved broadcasters in Canadian broadcast history. In fact, Sportsnet President Scott Moore, when speaking about Rod, once said, "You don't have to be a jerk to be a star. Just look at Rod Black." Which is deep evidence of the impact that Rod has had not only in the field of sports commentating, but also on other people who have had the chance to be in his presence. As soon as you hear Rod's voice, you will know immediately that he was destined for a career in broadcasting. Rod has covered a multitude of major sporting events over his career, such as the Summer and Winter Olympics, a number of them in fact, the NBA, Major League Baseball, professional hockey, the PGA Tour, football, and many other sports throughout his career. As well, he was one of the first newscasters to break the news of 9/11 to the Canadian public. And he will talk about how impactful that experience was in today's episode. Described as an unforgettable and consistent presence in Canadian sport broadcasting, Rod has deep gratitude and appreciation for his career, and speaks about this in our conversation as well. One of Rod's favorite quotes is something his father used to tell him often. He would tell Rod, "If you find a job you love, you'll never work a day in your life." Rod took that to heart and dropped out of college at the age of 19 to pursue his career in broadcasting, and the rest, as they say, is history. More than 40 years later, Rod has reached the pinnacle of his profession and continues to fearlessly reinvent himself. In this episode, he shares pearls of wisdom he has collected along his journey that have helped him achieve the success he has. Rod's enthusiasm and endless supply of positivity and energy are sure to inspire you to reflect on your own life and how you are purposely trying to pursue excellence in your own unique ways. In our conversation today, we cover the themes of community, resilience, the importance of constructing a positive inner voice, how to use feedback to leverage excellence in our lives, and how to create the conditions for mastery of our craft, whatever that craft may be. It was a true joy to have this conversation with Rod, and I really do hope you share it with anyone who you feel will benefit from listening. And with that, let's now jump right into my episode with the inspiring Rod Black. Rod, we've just kind of talked for the last 20 minutes, just, you know, talking about Canadian sports and common people that we know. And in advance to the conversation, I really want to thank you for the time. I'm abroad right now in Saudi Arabia, true and through Canadian, but have lived abroad for 25 years. And when I hear your name, and I've seen you on TV for so many years, and now we're having this chat, it's really special to me, and it makes me a bit homesick. But thank you for taking the time.
It's minus 15, Andy. It's minus 15. Don't be homesick. And it's great. It's great to chat with you and talk with you. And I remember you as a player as well. And it's nice to see you're abroad. But you're right. It's funny when you live around the world or travel around the world. It's so nice to see other places in the world, and nothing against anybody who's listening from anywhere else, but there's nothing like home and there's nothing like Canada.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's what intrigues me about your story. And I've done a lot of research beyond what the obvious is, you know, your amazing story and broadcasting. But if we were to do a flyover of early days, you know, just like a crop duster, just flying over, what would we see in young Rod? You know, like, well, think of yourself in elementary school, but what type of student were you, and what drove you, and what kind of support did you have, and what was your context like in early days?
Yeah, that's perfect that you said crop duster. I'm from the prairies. So I'm being from Winnipeg in a suburb just east of downtown in a place called Transcona. It's funny you're talking because I'm writing a book right now, sort of a memoir of all the stuff that I've done. And not because I'm bragging about what I've done, but I think my story is kind of I want it to be an inspirational story for people. I was that long shot kid. I was as much as I loved to play every sport when I was a kid imaginable. It's funny I'm in sports television because I watched every game. We were in I remember watching in a black and white box before color sports. It wasn't on as much, and once a week. And but it's funny that I'm in sports TV because I never watched a complete game. I'd only be there till about the second period or the third quarter, because I would be outside trying to mimic what I just saw or who I was pretending to be at the time, because I had so many sports heroes.
Which was who?
Well, I had a lot of them, you know, Andy. When I was growing up, Bobby Hull was a big, mostly because he came to Winnipeg and became a Jet, but I was also a big Montreal Canadiens fan, sorry, Leaf fans. Jean Béliveau, who I had a chance to meet. Like, I've had these crazy karma kismet meetings through the years that maybe kind of forged my path or taught me that, you know, even the most influential, incredible people that you meet along the way are just like you and I. Mm-hmm. And they're no different. They just have this inner fire that burns so bright. And I met Jean Béliveau at a gas station in 1970. I think it was 8 years old. And at that time, they had these power play cards, which was like little hockey cards, but they were stickers that you when your parents filled up the car, you got a pack. And there was always a mystery who was going to be in that pack. And so one day, and think about this, in Transcona, Manitoba, at the corner of Plessy and Regent, the only people who would know that are people from Winnipeg or from Transcona. Transcona is a small little hamlet at the time. And sure enough, we're there and we see this kind of little bit of a crowd, and there's sort of an activation or a tent. And we look, and it's Jean Béliveau. And I still have that picture today up. Contrary to what you believe, I got a lot of stuff behind me, but I don't collect a lot of it. And then Jean Béliveau was there, and you know, I was meeting God. It was incredible. It was like, I'll never forget that. And then same thing happened with Bobby Hull. And the crazy thing is I got to work with both men through the years. Unfortunately, sometimes, you learn a little bit about your heroes too, as we know. Yeah. Bobby Hull had some demons. But for the most part, Bobby Hull lit up rooms. So that was my guy growing up and pretending to be like him. And, you know, I'd go down to the rink. I'm so cold in Winnipeg in the winters. I'll never forget, you know, prior to school, which I had to be, which was across the street, we'd have to be in there for 8:45 in the morning in Winnipeg. And I would get up around 6 a.m. and get my younger brother, Derek, and we tire skates up in the landing area. And then we go outside.
The old leather skates.
Yeah, minus the CCM tackleberries and our straight sticks. And we'd actually, so cold, we skated down the back lane, probably half a kilometer, down the back lane to a rink that had one light because it was kind of a security light. It was called Pirates Community Club, the corner of Rosso and Plessy. And we jumped the boards and there we'd be banging pucks. And we got yelled at so much because at 7 o'clock in the morning, the neighborhood, you hit one puck, it resonate and echo throughout the neighborhood. But those moments were those moments that you never forget. They kind of, it was a different time, you know, now, and I'm not going to say, I hate being my dad and saying, oh, it was better then. I'm not going to ever say that because I think it is better today, but we didn't have those distractions like phones and Instagram and you know, the athletics today are so different because they're so money driven. We could barely find a place to play. And those were kind of those formative years for me. And plus, which is even crazier, you know, I do that for every sport. So I said that about Bobby Hull, like Gary Carter in baseball, Pete Rose in baseball, you know, in football, Tony Gabriel and Don Jonas, the quarterback for the Blue Bombers at the time, and a guy named Sonny Wade out of the Montreal Alouettes, who I absolutely adored. I wanted to be him. I always kind of wanted to be that. In basketball, it was Julius Erving, Dr. J. You know, it was unequivocal that's who I modeled any kind of my basketball game after. So I was always kind of these, like, you know, wanted to be, but because I was sort of a jack of all trade and I was pretty good at most of them. You know, I played to the junior level, but I just never focused on one because you didn't in those days. That's what you did. You played, I'm sure, Andy, how old are you?
55. I'll be 56 Tuesday.
Happy birthday. I'm 61. So we're kind of same vintage. And those were you played sports because, frankly, you didn't have a whole lot else to do. It was either that or do your homework.
But that's the thing, you know, when I think back to the day, I used to, like, I taught myself to punt. So I was quarterback punter for Windsor. And I literally taught myself how to punt by going to the library, looking at the books. And then my hero was Danny White because he was a quarterback and a punter, number 11, right?
Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah, Dallas Cowboys. And I literally spent every friggin' day in the backyard learning how to punt the football by a combination of being inspired by watching game days, but also looking at the books. And I think back to that time is like creativity and innovation. And as you say, no distractions with social media.
And just like my phone going off just now,
you know, like just making shit happen and trying to replicate what they do, you know,
and that's exactly it. And the library was, remember when the library, that's library and Sports Illustrated magazines.
Yeah.
You know, and newspaper was different. You got the scores. There was never really opinion, but that was Sports Illustrated kind of carved your narrative in sports. And I did the same thing. Golf. You know, I get every Jack Nicklaus book that I could possibly get. Yeah. And the little tips. I learned to play golf by reading the daily comic strips by Jack Nicklaus doing instruction. Yeah. That's how we did it back in those. And I'm not saying, again, it seems very primitive back then, but there was a beauty to it.
I remember telling my friend, because Jack Nicklaus talked about his coach, whatever his coach's name was, but Jack talked about his coach grabbing his hair to keep his head still. Yeah. And he hit it. So I would tell my friend, hold my hair, and I'd try to hit wedges from my backyard to the next backyard, you know, holding my head still where I could turn around.
Be an intervention. Now there'd be like there'd be a summit. Oh my gosh. You know, no, you can't have that happen. No, that's abuse. Well, it wasn't back then. It was teaching.
Yeah. And when you think of that, you know, like at 19 years old, you started your broadcasting with Winnipeg Jets. I think, you know, based on what I've read, and But 19 years old, so you're just out of high school. So there are some skills that you developed in the modern day, very different for people to get into broadcasting. So I'm sure you have a lot of gratitude for the path you were able to take, but how the hell were you able at your age, 19 years old, to break into that field? Going back to early days, what strengths did you develop that put you in the spotlight? To allow you to achieve that opportunity, I guess.
Yeah. So again, those early mornings were not only spent skating, but I also, when I was a kid, I had this fascination. I think I have a lot of voices in my head. I don't know, but I used to call into radio stations as a little kid, and I used to do impressions. I still do them now. And I used to, I call in and they, you know, do these characters. And I did that from started when I was about 10 to maybe like 12 years old. My parents didn't even know. They always used to go, who is that guy? Who is this Mr. Johnson? I used to do this character, Mr. Johnson. Anyway, I think that kind of gave me sort of the confidence to talk, to converse, to maybe want to become a broadcaster. Because I watched so many of the games, and I had all of this stuff going on in my head. But at the same time, I still wanted to be an athlete. I wanted to play sports, and I doing both, getting into theater, becoming a character, getting a job at a roller rink as a DJ. All of these little things were kind of conspiring to my path. And then I had an opportunity when I was like 17 to get a scholarship offer in the States. And I was in the state of Minnesota, and I was on my way down there. I'll never forget. And I decided, no, I want to take this creative communications course at Red River Community College locally, probably get into radio, maybe get into advertising or maybe some acting. I wasn't even sure. I kind of liked the DJ stuff. Did it for 1 year because we graduated a little earlier in Manitoba back then. So I was 17 going to go to Red River. It's my 18th year. They have this job opening at a local station for a sports broadcaster. And like you said that perfectly. You don't get too many opportunities. Mm. Even now, a 19-year-old doesn't get in for sure without the experience. Back then, unheard of. And everybody back then who was a broadcaster, especially in sports, looked like me now, you know, an old guy. And I said, nah, I'm not getting in. And sure enough, I got in and I first in line. I thought this could be my dream job, and I got the job, and really kind of the rest is history. Yeah. And it gave me, by getting that job, it's not just the belief that I think I had. I was pretty confident. I was also very shy. Even to this day, I'm not one of those guys that just, you know, you meet right away, you get to know me, and you know, contrary to our lives under the light. But it was like this life changing moment. And I just said, you know what, if this is, it's kind of like an athlete getting drafted or whatever. Even though I was an athlete, I still played sports, by the way, as I continued to play. But it was so life changing. This guy named Peter Young was the sports director. He worked at CTV. So I went in and I just decided I quit the course I was on, which I kind of regretted, but I had this new path, Andy. It was like incredible. And I treated it so seriously that it was like I was taking a master's course in broadcasting. And every single day I would work. I was sad that there was only 24 hours in a day because I would just be there early. I golf early in the morning, actually, or play a sport. Then I go to work. Sometimes even in the middle of work, I'd go play with one of my teams because you didn't have to be there the whole time. We didn't have games going on video all the time. So it was insane time. And then just opportunities happen, like the Jets broadcast opportunity. And so that's kind of how it happened. And again, I think the harder you work, the luckier you get. And I would say I was lucky to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, and that's what I talked to Joe Siddall about. So we talked about Joe Siddall. I interviewed him a few weeks ago, former.
By the way, Joe's a fantastic broadcaster too. He's become a really good analyst on the Blue Jay broadcast and such a terrific guy.
Yeah,
and I broadcast him. You know what's crazy? When he was with the Expos, I was one of the Expos broadcasters. I don't know if he knows that, but that's hilarious.
Yeah, and what I think about when I hear your story is like you know, you allude to the fact that you worked really hard to understand sport. So there's the analytical aspect of it. So going back to the day, I used to open up the World Almanac and study statistics of the best punters and then compare myself as a 13-year-old, where I would walk out 35 yards or 40 yards just by, you know, and then throw down some sticks and then throw down some sticks on the other side at 42 yards and then try to punt that distance. You know, I broke it down in an analytical way to try to understand what I needed to do to compare against the best punters, you know, professionally. And, but at the time, you know, just feeling this is your path. And what I shared with Joe was when I hear his story and what he's been through, losing his son, and then ending up broadcasting, I thought of a quote, and I shared this quote in the podcast with him. It's from Oprah. And the quote is, "I believe every one of us is born with a purpose. No matter who you are, what you do, or how far you think you have to go, you have been tapped by a force greater than yourself to step into your God-given calling." And it sounds like you, it was like a perfect storm. This sports-minded young person who was so passionate about sport, yet stepped into this theater to allow you to express yourself in ways that connected to your soul, right? So can you just talk about what resonates with you with that quote, but the hard work you had to do for the next 30 years to be able to accomplish what you have?
Yeah, I've read that quote many times. You know, it's funny though. And you know, it's again, crazy coincidences that I had a chance to interview Oprah a couple of times, which whenever, you know, if somebody's, I'm going like, really, this guy from Transcona gets to interview all these people. And I don't think she ever said that in that during that time, but her, it's kind of her life mantra. And she's a real good role model. She's a great leader too. And I think people gravitate to great leadership, and you need mentors and leaders, and whether it comes from a book, that's great. Whether it comes from somebody you meet, that's great. It comes somebody close to you, I think that's even better. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I had people around me like that, like that were Oprah, like that, that gave you nudges. And I think you need a nudge every once in a while. People need and honest nudges. And so they, you know, I had some really positive people, my friends around me said, you guys should do this. This is what you should do. And that gives you confidence. And I parents give you confidence. My parents were, what I loved about them is that they never pushed, but they encouraged, you know, they put, because there's so many parents that like to interfere. I think we all go step back sometimes. No, we've all been guilty. Back in that era, my folks just never pushed. They just wanted to say, whatever it is you do. My dad had the greatest quote ever. He said, find a job you like, you'll never work a day in your life. Mm-hmm. And that I always maintained that. And so that belief system, the purpose, I am not, first of all, truth be told, I'm spiritual. I'm not religious. I always talk to people about the church that I went to was it was a hockey rink or a baseball diamond on Sundays. And that's nothing against religion. It just, that's, we were so busy always playing sports, including my kids. We still go. And I think, you know, again, one of the beauties of being in a congregation, whether it's religious, whether it's secular or non-secular, is that when you have people around you, you have to, some people, I'm sure your path too, you know, if you didn't have people around you, it's so easy to be that guy. Like you were like me, go out by yourself, get your analytics, your own little, write your book, read your book, get your analytics, get study where you are. But if you don't have people, it's a lonely journey.
Yeah.
And that purpose is not even purposeful if you don't. So I think that had a lot to do, but the resilience is huge too. And that's, I think that is something that's, people think that's naturally born or that is another force. I think that's really something that is developed because you have to develop that, that thick skin, that self-deprecation that you need that, but also that get off the mat and get up fighting. You know, I always say that rock bottom is good. Rock bottom's a trampoline. Mm-hmm. Bounce, bounce, yeah, bounce, bounce. We've all been there. Mm-hmm. Whatever your rock bottom is, I don't, you know, some people have had worse bottoms, you know. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's trite saying it, but I always think, you know, whatever you have, everybody has bad days and has tragic things happen in their life. But yeah, there is, I think there is some sort of messaging in there that you have to bounce. And you also have to understand that there are so many other people in the world that are going through something equally bad or even worse. And that amount of gratitude, I think, has to stay with you. But I do love that quote. You're right. And again, going through my book now, every chapter I go through, I realize, man, you don't see it though. In your journey, you don't see that. I think the people who have a real strong religious base probably go to it, but the person in it, and you're so busy, it's like great athletes. You know, Michael Jordan never grew up thinking he was going to be the greatest basketball player ever. Yeah. You know, there's not a chance he did, but he wanted to be the best basketball player that he could be. So, you know, all the little things that happen so fast, and you have to be proactive and reactive that you don't think about the force until later. When you're looking back, then you understand it and you go, yeah, there is something that is that divining rod, pardon the pun, that is just carrying you along. And I also think it's logic. Sometimes it's just logic. Like, okay, here's your talent. This is what you're good at. Mm-hmm. And if you're not good at it, I've always said to people like, you know, hey, I say it to my kids. If they want to quit a sport or somebody wants to quit something, you can quit. There's no harm in quitting. You better find something else that you're good at, though. Mm-hmm. Pick something else up. Because mm-hmm. We've all also stepped aside, but no, I can't do this. So yeah, purpose is an ethereal word, but it is a guiding light. I really do think it's a guiding light.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to what you're saying is like going with the flow and understanding your talents, and there's going to be ups and downs, but a lot of research in positive psychology now suggests that the more we are aligned to our core values in life, and the more that we do the hard internal work to try to figure out what matters most to us, and then use that as a vetting system in moving forward, we always have it as an anchor point. And it goes back to that ability to be self-aware. So catching ourselves and saying, this is the moment, this is the present moment, you know, and really being in that moment to find the flow necessary to tap into our God-given talents or potential or whatever it is we're meant to do to serve the world. And with that comes the internal narrative and what we're saying to ourselves. You know, one of the great sports psychology mentors that I've had him on the podcast. I've never met him face to face is Dr. Jim Lehrer, the power of narrative and what he talks about. And his quote is, the power broker in your life is the voice that no one hears. How well you revisit the tone and content of your private voice is what determines the quality of your life. It's the master storyteller, and the stories we tell ourselves create our reality. So when I heard that quote about 7 years ago, I was like, that's it, man. Like, you know, what we say to ourselves is so important in our journey of excellence. And what was your inner critic like in your career? Like, were you harsh with yourself? Were you judgmental? Did you learn to be self-compassionate when you made mistakes? Like, what was that journey like in trying to find your inner voice so that it supports your journey of excellence?
Yeah, I would say it's always a work in progress, and I think everybody have to admit that. I'm one of those guys that's never satisfied. So like, you know, it's like, okay, well, people go, what's your greatest sports event that you've ever been around? And but well, tomorrow is it? Like, you know, I could rank, you know, I've been so gifted and lucky to have these things privileged. To be able to do what I did, but it was through hard work. So I looked at those as always being gifts and sort of the pot of gold. But, you know, Edmund Hillary said it best is that, you know, when he got to the top of Mount Everest, he looked around and goes, holy shit, there are more mountains to climb. You know, that's kind of, I've always appreciated and that quote. And I've always appreciated people who are like that, that keep moving on. Like some people are just satisfied being, and that's fine. If you're satisfied being satisfied, but I think your inner voice also tells you, to me, it's always been a propellant. Move, like, you know, and hey, we all make mistakes and I'm very critical. Like, and it's my inner voice. So I go, oh God, no. Oh yeah. Go. But it's, as long as those mistakes can be fixed and corrected, is it correctable or apologized for? And they're not egregious life mistakes. There's a difference between making mistakes as a broadcaster or making mistakes as, you know, financially or whatever, but there's bigger mistakes in life that are, mm-hmm. that are illegal or whatever. And those mistakes are really hard to bounce back from. Nowadays, mistakes, you know, it's insane, but the mistakes you make today as a broadcaster or a public speaker or somebody who's in the limelight, those are so compounded. And to me, they, you know, like, well, why is somebody getting canceled because of like that? They can't apologize. You know, there's no mea culpa in the world anymore and gone, you know, you're mm-hmm. gone. And yet, you know, what's interesting too, is in on formats like this podcast, people can say whatever the hell they want to say.
Yeah.
Rarely do they get taken to the mat on it and they can go, but they go on the air and they can't because of regulation, which is fine. But my inner voice was always, was always about getting, I got it from Jack Donahue. I went to a national junior camp years ago. And I use this a lot in a lot of my speaking stuff, is that, you know, he taught us the power of these acronyms that I use to this day. And we used to write them down in our shoes. We used to write them down on our socks, wristbands, wherever, when you had to write. Remember those days?
Yeah.
Those people out there, writing is a thing. We had this tool called a pen and another tool called a pencil or a marker. And you wrote, you didn't use your thumbs. Those days it was, you didn't want to be all thumbs. Now you want to be all thumbs. So I remember going to a national junior evaluation camp or development camp in Winnipeg. And he had these things written on the board. It was ABC, ICE, WIN, and BED. So ABC, ICE, WIN, and BED. And I had no clue. You know, I mean, and they were out there for like 4 days before he finally told us to write them down and use them. And I've kind of, they have been lifelong acronyms of, have been affirmations for me. ABC, adversity builds character, which is absolutely right. It does. And I when you learn that at a young age, that's important because you know everybody goes through it. ICE was intensity, concentration, and enthusiasm that you have to bring every day. And some days you can't, it's impossible. And these are all easy. These are kind of like, you know, everybody go, oh yeah, sure, whatever. And it's kind of like a Tony Robbins thing. And but they're not. If you listen to your inner voice too, and go, you know what? I do need to be more intense. I need to concentrate more, and I need to be more enthusiastic. And then win was it's not the obvious of winning. It's what's important now. What's important right now. Right now, right today, not tomorrow, not yesterday. That took a long time for me, Andy. I will tell you. I would say up until I was probably 50, did I ever get that? I think 50 is a magical age for men that they, you know, it's sad. You're more than halfway to the back nine and it's like, oh my God, what the hell have I been doing my entire 35 is a big age. I think that's a real good one. But for men in particular, just to be 50 was like magical. Plus you also got to start wearing readers. but the last one was probably the most important one, BED, bed. And I thought, go to bed after being, you know, get rest, because they all can actually mean good things, but it means better every day. Get better every single day, every single moment. I've always, and again, it's easy to say, you know, nobody has, and I've had those days too. I go, oh man, I'm so tired. Can't do this. But if you can get better by 1%, one inch, that one inch, that 1% every single day, do you know how much better our world would be? I'm sure politicians took that into effect or, you know, like, some of the powerful people in the world took that into effect, but I think the most successful people do get better every day. They're never satisfied. I'm not, I'm just one of those people. And that's those. So that was kind of my voices. Like I said, I had a lot of voices in my head. I think I've had so many swirling through my head, whether it's impressionable people who I did impressions of or my own inner voice that I kind of take to hearing quotes or affirmations or power play comments that stick with you and you go, yes, the ahas So I've had those. Those were really important to me. And bed has been so important in my life, and it will continue to be until they finally put me in my final bed.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And it's that idea of James, what's his name? He wrote Atomic Habits, James Clear. And what he says is the aggregation of marginal gains, right? And that 1% better every day. And especially at the elite level, you know,
yes.
If you're a 36 handicap, you're going to drop to a 28, then you're going to drop to a 24. You're going to make massive gains, but a scratch player is not going to drop to a plus four overnight. Whereas a high handicapper can. And
the 10,000 hour, like I always say to people, like, and you've gone through this because you played at an elite level. I was lucky enough to play some sports at that elite. And you love golf like I do. And you're right. When you get down to, I was the lowest I got was like a 5. And I will tell you, I think I'm a better player today. And I'm not a 5. Like I'm a 12 or 13. I'm a better player today than I ever was. But the getting down from that 5 is so mental, mentally draining. But also it's the 10,000 hours. And I buy the 10,000 hours. You need to do that. That's obvious. You know, Tiger Woods is the greatest golfer ever. Because why? He's hit more golf balls than anybody else.
Yeah.
But he hit them smartly. And I don't think everybody's, 10,000. It has to be 10,000 hours, not of hard work, of smart work.
Absolutely.
Smart, guided work. You talked about purpose. In your head, am I doing the right thing?
Yeah. And, you know, Ben Hogan, I heard this story about Ben Hogan where he took a basket of balls and he put the basket of balls 2 meters behind him so that he would have to go hand pick a ball, walk back to drop it on the grass, to be methodical in his pre-shot routine, to visualize the shot he wanted to hit, to step into it and hit it, and then accept whatever happened, and then walk back, take a breath, pick another ball, and walk back. Instead of mindlessly banging out 100 seven irons in a row without thinking, right?
Rolling it up, rolling it out of the bucket. We all do it. Roll it out of the little bucket, roll it over, hit it, roll it over, hit it, roll it over, hit it.
Yeah. And that's not purposeful. And
that's
you know, I had Simon Whitfield on the podcast, one of my favorite podcasts of all time.
I love that guy.
Yeah. Simon talked about this idea when he was 17 years old, when they announced that the Olympics were going to be in Sydney, and he was training in Sydney at the time. And he knew 5 years in advance that the Olympics were going to be there, 4 years, whatever it was. And they made the announcement and the city was partying, you know, and then he's with his friends on the street and everybody's pounding beers. And then he walks right to the starting point, right by the Sydney Opera House, the starting point of the triathlon. And he stands at the starting spot and he looks out, nobody around him. It's dark, it's midnight. And he's visualizing diving into the water as the first leg of the triathlon and winning the gold medal. And what he said in the podcast was, see in your mind's eye that which you want to become, and the power of visualization. And these beautiful athletes who have worked so hard in their life and grounded not in genetics, just being born with talent, but working your nuts off every day to do the work that you're going to do to make a difference, you know? And when you think back to your career, I always get emotional, maybe because I'm in my 50s now. I look back and I watch these videos, but when you think back to like monumental moments in your career, are there any moments that come alive where you had to, like, you know, choke back the tears or like overcome the emotion of what you were watching to stay present to still call the game?
Oh yeah. All the time. And it still happens. And it's really because we're human. I don't want to be a robot. And I think one of the strengths, if I had any strength as a broadcaster, it was that I brought a lot of emotion and compassion to the games. It just wasn't about scores and plays for me. It's always been about the stories. I want to know your story before I go in. I want to know the good stories, and I want to see how those stories are framed around a result and how those people react to a result. The beauty of sports is that there are no authors. Mm-hmm. There are no endings. You know, they can't craft them. You know, there's, it's so unpredictable. So when that unpredictability happens that you're not ready for, it's even when you are actually, I remember Joanie Rochette. I really had to hold that together in 2010 at the Vancouver Olympics. She lost her mom and we were all wondering, she's not going to skate, is she? And sure enough, I see her on the ice the day before. She made the decision last minute. I just wanted to, and you know, when I was doing skating, we had such a tight world. Everybody knew each other. And I remember her coming around the rink at that practice. And I was with Tracy Wilson, who was actually working for NBC at the time. I was sitting there with her and also with Jennifer Robinson and Saleh and Peltier and our commentating team and our researcher. And I remember she comes around and she sees me and she gives me that kind of that look. She's doing her stroking, that look. And it's kind of like, I'd never seen somebody with that look before in sports, where it was like, I'm okay, but I'm really sad. I'm really, really sad. And I just wanted to give her a hug. You know, I was like, oh man, how's she going to do this? And then when she skated beautifully, beautifully. And it was like so emotional. I remember our booth, everybody's crying. And I really had a tough time keeping it together. The beauty is that we're not on camera and we can mute our mics if you can hear anybody sobbing. But I will tell you, there were a lot of tears and I really had to hold that together to, I don't know, whatever I said at the end. And sometimes that's the best way. That's the way I kind of always live my life in broadcasting, is just say what you should be said. And I think I said something along the line that under the circumstance that it was like a gold medal skate, nobody, just being here was her Olympics. And then she ended up winning a bronze medal. And that was, those kind of moments happen. And I can tell you, it happens a lot. I can tell you, CIS, which I still like calling it CIS football. Yeah. Sorry, I don't like the U Sports thing. I've never liked it.
Neither do I.
Never will like it. I think it's, I don't care. Whoever came up with that idea,
yeah,
I don't know, should be banished and forced to listen to to me for the rest of their life. I don't like it. I just never liked it. It doesn't come off your, I like CIS. And anyway, 2011, we did the Mac Laval game. It was probably the best football game I've ever broadcast, been around anything. I mean, you know, they go to overtime, and they win. And even that, you get emotional at that. I remember that, like, you know, I'm going, holy crap, this is like, oh, and it's a different emotion. Mm. And then there's, you know, so you can have the sad mode. And I think that's good in a broadcaster sometimes. And of course you have to be objective, but, and you know what happens, of course, and when you do get so emotion one way or another, you get inevitable critics from everywhere. I mean, if you're wearing a blue tie when the Saskatchewan Rough Riders are playing, you know, they immediately think you're cheering for Winnipeg or Toronto, whatever, whatever. We don't cheer for anybody. We cheer for good games. But then you can have, you know, that emotion that comes in during tragic moments. And my career also took me to the news side in Canada AM. Great experience. I you know, again, made me a better every day. I wanted to learn more about interviewing. I wanted to learn more about being more conversational, more about the news, more about politics. I wanted that.
Can you share that story? Because I did want to ask you about that. Like, that's like, I still remember we were living in Japan at the time. You know, we'd lived in Japan for 10 years and a friend picked me up at the train station to drive me home. I had just taken a long train ride and he said, a plane hit the towers, you know? And I thought it was a small plane. I didn't know what was going on. When I got home, my wife was watching and we had been in New York 4 months before. Her mom lived in New York. So can you just take us through what was happening at that time for you?
Well, emotions, that's what that's another side of emotions, you know, around something that's tragic. You know, we've all had gone through that stuff, but here you're a broadcaster. So it's my second day with the team. I'd done Canada AM in the past, but our new team of Lisa LaFlamme, myself and Jeff Hutchinson, it was our second day as a team. I just came from Sunday, I broadcast the Canadian Open. Scott Verplank had won.
Yeah.
In Montreal, and I remember coming in, I'm going, okay, tomorrow morning, I got to get in. It's our first day on the job. fantastic. I look forward to, I'm still doing sports, but I want to do news too. I'm looking forward because it was, I say to people all the time, it was the only show that you can interview Terry Clark, Wendell Clark, and Joe Clark in the same hour. It's like, you know, a singer, a hockey player, a former prime minister. And I love that. And, you know, cooking, it was just get people up with a good mood in the morning. So first day went fine. Next day, and again, back to emotions. You know, like I'm sitting there, I'm interviewing a TV guide guy, and we're talking about the, it's 9:15 Eastern time. We're talking about the upcoming fall season and the shows. And then all of a sudden I get a Shelly Ayers as our producer comes in my ear and goes, Rod, we're going to have to go to break. A plane has flown into the World Trade Center. And I went, oh. So I immediately said, and I think we were the first, I know that, not that you want to be the first, but we were the first to announce that because we had a camera affixed on to the World Trade Center, not affixed to it, but looking at it because we had a guest coming up in the next hour. So it was immediate from her, immediate to me. We go to break, come back. We, same thing as you thought it was a small plane. We see the hole in the World Trade Center and in the one tower, and we're kind of, we got an FAA person on the line. We're going through this. Planes have flown into buildings in New York before. They flew into the Empire State Building. They've flown into buildings. So that's what we thought. Oh my gosh, what a terrible accident. Small plane. Hole looked pretty big though. So about, this is like just after 9. We are interviewing the FAA person. Lisa's talking to them and all of a sudden, boom. And Lisa thinks at the time, we're looking at a replay. And I went, that's not a replay. This is not an accident. This is a terrorist attack. Mm. Another plane. And so now we're on the air for, you know, 6 to 8 hours. And again, you talked about your purposes in life, what happens, build yourself to that moment when you have to have that opportunity to do something, whatever it might be in any part of your life, just be ready for that opportunity. And I think my grounding in sports really, and ability to improvise and to not need a script helped me through that because it was emotional. I remember getting real, like not on the air. That's funny. I didn't get emotional on the air, but when the towers fell, I think I have PTSD from that because it was like we were there and we were broadcasting it to the world. When the towers fell, I went, oh my God, I cannot believe that.
Yeah. You know, I was on my knees crying.
And my, so that's, it. Yeah. So now I'm thinking that people forget, you know, Andy, we all forget, even after the pandemic, you know, everybody's kind of like loosey goosey now still with a lot of the restrictions or wearing masks and all that. There was a reason we had a pandemic, you know, there's a reason we needed to be safe and needed to be vaccinated. Anybody who doesn't think that, they're fooling themselves. We're here today because of the vaccines. I mean, like, let's face it, yada, yada, all of that stuff. Same thing back then. I think today we're still loose again with security. Like people forget. I know it was 22 years ago. That was a significant, impactful event in our lives. Mm-hmm. Like the pandemic. But on that day, we thought we were attacked. We thought we were at war. And so afterwards, I got off around 3:00. Lloyd Robertson came in to take over. I got up and I remember going back to my office. And I know I just had a newborn son. He was back home. My mom was in town. My wife was at the hairdresser. She raced back. Everybody raced back. They stopped their lives. Everybody wondered what was going on. Are we being attacked? And I remember I had that breakdown in the office. I went, oh my gosh, these cowards have done this. They have done this. And I was very, very, that got me. And then, you know, that was such a grind. You know, instead of that morning show that I thought we were going to wake people up for the next year and a half, all we did was talk about it. And, you know, the security and the and from the right to the left, how we are going to deal with people who are affected, you know, especially our Muslim population, how they're affected by the way we criticize or we are, you know, the attack that was going on around the world. It became a bigger story. And honestly, it ground me to a halt in that job. I didn't want to do it anymore. I want to get back to sports.
So I guess my next question is, like, if we think about that moment and the ability to deal with emotion in the present moment, literally, is a skill that we build. And you talk about this idea of these things happen and we can ruminate about the past, we can project into the future, but all you have is the present moment. And that's what Joe talked about, you know, and the podcast is commentating, you have the camera on you and boom, you're on. And Joe talked about this idea of like kind of having a script in the early days and then had to throw out the script early and rely on your intuitive strengths to get you through the present moment. So what is your advice to people who have a lot of talent that get barricaded and present their own obstacles? They throw their own obstacles in the way of their success. Yeah. What is your advice to people to just trust their inner capacity to get the job done, which means accept failure, but take that in whatever direction you want?
Yeah, they're so easy to sabotage yourself. I love what Joe said there, because we've all done it. And when you first start broadcasting, here's the one thing about broadcast, and I don't think this is about broadcasting. I do a lot of speaking and courses with businesses and high schools. And by the way, some of the highest executives, I'm sure as you've seen, some of the greatest executives in the world who make billions of dollars do not have the basic, simple conversational communication skills that some kids in high school have. It's funny. Like, yeah. I think it's a confidence thing for some people, whatever. I think though that it's all a teachable, learnable skill. I really do. You're going to get better. Like I said, better every day. I said, if you do something, if you play the piano every day, even though you suck at it, you suck now and you suck then, you're still going to be better. You're not going to suck as bad as you once did. Mm-hmm. I kind of have that thought in it, especially in broadcasting too. So when you write stuff down, I'm a big believer in doing a lot of reading and a lot of writing, because if you write, the way you write is kind of the way you form your thoughts. You've got to kind of put that's your foundation. But you also have to have this inner voice in you that knows how to frame a story, and it's a storytelling, right? Joe's a really good storyteller, and I think when we all first start telling stories, anybody, Will Ferrell, Jim Carrey, you name the greatest comics, I say to people all the time, and they go, oh my God, they're so funny, look at how natural they are. That joke has been written out 100 times. When they first told that joke sucked. You know what I'm saying? Same thing with a great speech. Abraham Lincoln, JFK, go through all the great speech. Barack Obama is one of the greatest orators I think we've ever been around. Bill Clinton, same thing. Great orators. Stuff is written for them. Have you ever seen when they're not, or don't have a script? A little different. Yeah. I think if we have our own script in our life and we can tell good stories, it helps us with our path. I firmly believe that. If you know you're firm in your beliefs, you know, I trust your opinion. We can disagree on whatever, but if you're firm in your beliefs and you trust your own script, and that's your, like we talked about earlier, your purpose, or you're being purposeful, it helps you communicate that to people, to converse with people. There are some people who are not great communicators, and that's fine. You don't have you don't have to say a word in life. You can communicate other ways. You know, you can communicate. There's some people who have the inability there are people that have the inability to speak, and they're some of the best communicators I've ever been around, because they can write it out and talk it out, or not talk it out, but write it out, form it out. And when I say talk it out, they have machines that can actually, I've been around some physically handicapped people who have a machine that forms their words because they can't talk. And I go, if that person can do that and they can tell a great story, why can't we all tell our own great stories? You know, like, it's like, really? You said what? So I think that's kind of that's been that inner script. And by the way, as you put more years on and put more miles and more layers on, you can't, experience is something you get only when you get it.
if you're willing to put yourself in the arena.
If you're willing to put yourself there and you're willing to learn from it too, because otherwise, why just go through life? You just walk through life like a zombie? No, we're not zombies. And I do think as I show you my cell phone, I think we're getting to a world where we got to stop. I know people are conversing but you got to wonder what your message is. Never miss an opportunity to meet somebody. Never miss an opportunity to ask good questions. Never miss an opportunity to listen, to what people say.
Yeah, without reloading. And that's the, you know, I think there's a sense of vulnerability there that you're sharing, because you have to be vulnerable to share your truth, whatever your truth is in the moment. Now,
you can armor yourself up.
You can armor yourself up and not speak your truth, your authentic truth.
Yeah.
But I know you have embraced that idea, maybe consciously but unconsciously, of vulnerability, of speaking your truth, right? Mm-hmm. So before we segue to a close, just share your experience with vulnerability and how you were able to build the skill to better sit with vulnerability in your life, both personally and professionally.
I had to learn. I will be honest with you, I wasn't good at it at the beginning. You know, I was not good accepting criticism early on, but I knew my inner script and my inner purpose, I pushed through it, you know, and I went, oh, whatever, whatever is okay. Unless you're, somebody says something or is criticizing you for something, unless they're just a miscreant or they're just angry people, there's probably something there that for a criticism that you probably should look at, you know? And so I was not good at it. And it took me a while. It took me into my 20s. Again, when you're 20, got into the game so early. When you're a 20-year-old, you think you can do anything in the world. And then you send them home. No, but I realized quickly that these mistakes that you, or the criticisms that you're going to face in life are going to help you. I said before about the trampoline effect, just being able to bounce. So that sense of vulnerability, the beauty is to know that it can be rectified. I was still maybe to this day, very non-confrontational. Somebody's in my face or somebody, you know, I'm not good at that, but I'm getting better. And mm-hmm. I think that's the thing, better every day, get better at, and now I don't mind saying, hey, no, you're wrong, but we can have a conversation about this. It doesn't have to be, you know, especially from the sports background, Andy, you probably see this, you know, our testosterone-filled males have a tendency to, first thing is to fight, you know, like, oh, and whether it's argument or physical, I've never had a physical altercation, but the thing is to fight. You invaded my space? No, we're better than that. It takes a man to say you're sorry. It takes a man to say you're wrong. When you're wrong, right? To say you're wrong. And so those vulnerabilities happens as a broadcaster. You really quickly realize, let's fix it, move on. Mm-hmm. And don't have too many fixes. Even when stuff happens in your life, in your career, I had a job for 40 years. And then all of a sudden, you know, there's a financial purge at a company where they're telling people to take salary cuts or, you know, move on or do whatever. I don't want to be part of that. I mean, that's very vulnerable to this. It's been 2.5 years since I departed Bell Media. I'm still a broadcaster and I still got a lot left in me in my tank. And I like my next lap. I like the next lap where I'm going to be and what I'm going to do. And I'm still doing games. It's just not with them. It took me a long time to get over the fact, well, this has been my life. And I can understand people getting into having addiction problems or depressions, because you go through it, but that vulnerability from where I was there, and you had a lot, I go back to what I said before about relationships and people. I had so many people saying, hey, this is what you have to do. This is where you need, and sometimes you need to talk about, and you need help, and you go, I really was always a reticent person. If I never needed a hand, I got a tree outside to cut down a tree, let's say, and I'd try to do it myself, and freaking tree would fall on me. You need a hand cutting down trees. You need a hand. And sometimes just asking the way you ask, how it is, and asking the right person, having the great support group around you really, really helps dig out of that hole of vulnerability. I firmly believe that. And again, the positivity in it, in my mind, and you know, I'm a glasses half full guy, is that tomorrow's going to be better. It's going to be better, man. Every piece of dark has a great ray of light coming through. You're going to get better. It's going to get better. It can never be like this for a long time. It can hurt. And you get bitter. Make bitter your better.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And Dr. Michael Gervais, the performance psychologist for the Seattle Seahawks, he started a business with Pete Carroll called Compete to Create. And I was in their first test group and I trained under Michael. And what Dr. Michael says is, Dr. Michael Gervais says is, confidence doesn't come from what you do on the field. Confidence comes from what you say to yourself. But it's not based on fluffy bullshit. It's based on actually having done the work, putting yourself in the arena, as Brené Brown says, put yourself in the arena. So if you accept feedback from people, don't accept feedback from people in the cheap seats up top, you know, armchair quarterbacks barking bullshit down to you.
The man in the arena.
Yeah, accept feedback from the people that matter in your life. And then you learn to accept when you make mistakes, rather than cover them up and put on a mask, you accept what shreds of truth exist in the feedback, you know, without personalizing it. So going back to, I know we're limited on time, but I'm really interested in this idea of how do you depersonalize feedback to make it not personal, but more objective, so that you actually put yourself in the best position possible to learn and grow.
Yeah, I think exactly what you just said is take a look at who, take a look at the person who's giving you the feedback or the people that are giving you the feedback, and take it for what it is. I mean, if I'm building a cabinet in my house, and I'm probably from IKEA, and I've screwed it up, there's probably a reason. I couldn't read the instructions, or you know, I need somebody. I need, come and help me. It's amazing how we do that, right? When we, can you help me with this? But when it's personal, when it's more personal, we put on sort of this superhero cape and we say, no, we, you know, no, I can do this myself, or, you know, you're wrong. Or, and I had to really, I don't know if it was depersonalized. I had to, and still do, again, you deal with critics all the time, but whatever. You know, they can just take it from where they come from. If they're coming from a space of, I generally looked at, for instance, if somebody said something or wrote something, because there was always these TV critics that would write whatever, you know, like we were trying our best. If we made a logical mistake, for sure, but they would just pick and pick and pick. And it was, there was sometimes you realize it's they have an agenda. Or it's political because of being a left wing, right wing, middle, whatever. And especially with someone like me, because I just tell it like it is. I always have and always will. And I'm, you know, like I say, I got a lot of passion in the game. I'm not a robot. So somebody would say something, and then I would actually write them back. I'd say, really? I just go, really? Dot, dot, dot. And then they explain, and or I'd phone them. Say, so that's fine. You know, okay, well, I explain why you think that. And I said, here's what my thought was. And generally, it was crazy. However, when I actually confronted that person, amazing what happens. In a nonviolent way. And amazing how the next time.
Beautiful.
You know, otherwise they come at you like crazy, right? Like if you throw honey on yourself, wasps are going to come at you. that's going to happen. So, And another time I realized one of these writers or whatever, I saw them because I would go into scrum. I never really went into scrums. And I see the person who was also gravitating to another sport in the scrum, and asked a really stupid frickin' question, really stupid, to Don Matthews, at the time was the head coach of the Alouettes. And I'm going, so the filter down at the scrum, he admonishes this person, and I go, I just look at the person, go, see, see, there you go. And it's not a winning thing. It's not like I wanted to get the last say, but you know what? I kind of did. And it was like
learning moment.
Careful what you do. You know, I would say that even like we criticize. I will, Andy, I'm sure if I was doing one of your games and you were two for 15 passing through four picks, one including one of pick six. You know, you're going to get criticized. It's not going to be glowing. So I always say, you do something great, you're going to get applauded. You do something crappy, you're going to get criticized, but I never wanted to take it personal. I hate personal attacks. I don't like that. I don't like, that's what I don't like about Twitter. I don't like about all that. Personal is bullying. That's a different animal. I remember coming in out of a game in Saskatchewan. We had a great game. And of course, Rough Riders were playing the Blue Bombers. And there's this fan gets in my face as we're going back to our car. And he's a young kid. Got his face paint, Rod Black, you suck. You got your suck this. And he's standing right in front of me. And it looks like he wants to fight me. I'm going like, Jesus, man, this team lost clearly. And I just looked at him and go, how's your mom? hey, how's your mom? And then I just walked off. And it was like, I looked back at him. He looked like this pouting little boy. He had no comeback. It was like,
there's no comeback to that.
There you go, buddy. Hey, we're all human. We're all gonna get ripped from time to time. We're all gonna have those great moments. Rick Hillier. Have you ever had him on your show?
No.
Rick Hillier is to me one of the greatest people I've ever met in my life. General, of course, chief of the Canadian military during Afghanistan. Fantastic speaker. He's become a friend. Good man. And, you know, what he had to do with his army and his armies as he went through several deployments is that he had to make sure that there was no ego involved in his leadership, that it was always he checked his ego. It wasn't about him. It was about bringing that team together, bringing his soldiers, his men and his women together, and to understand them personally and to get to know them so that he understood their narratives, where they come from, their journeys. And he said it took more time than most generals would, but I would rather do that than be that person who's a forceful leader who knows nothing about the human. And I think this is good for a lot of people in business, because they don't. A lot of presidents and CEOs have no clue. You're just a number, you're this and this. You get to know the person, understand. Might have to make a harsh decision, but you'll understand the person. You'll understand. And Hillier always says that about the ego, that you got to check that. You can't. Great leadership comes from, and he puts it near the top of his tenets of leadership. You know, remembering that we are one and we play for the same team and yada yada, all of those kind of cliche things that it's obvious. But they said, make sure you check your ego. And I think from time to time, we all have to do that. We all have egos. We all get hurt and stung by something that happens in our life. But if you can find a way to check it at the door, it makes it a whole lot easier. A whole lot easier.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I was running today listening to a podcast about Peyton Manning's pursuit of excellence and what...
Peyton Manning and Eli.
Eli and Archie, right?
Omaha.
And Peyton talked, or not Peyton, but the story was that after the season ended, they didn't make the Super Bowl, whatever. And Peyton, 7 a.m. the next day, he's there with his film guy and he's saying, show me every pick that I threw the year before. And then they look at every pick. And then Peyton, with his pencil and paper, says, avoidable pick or unavoidable? And goes through every pick of the season, 20 picks or 19 picks, whatever it was, then says, give me every almost pick, avoidable or unavoidable. And then I'm going to look at the patterns, and the patterns when I threw avoidable picks was when linemen were falling at my feet. So I didn't step into the throw. I didn't commit to the throw, and the throws were a bit like, you know, floppy. And then the next year, the coaches designed some drills to throw heavy bags at his feet as he was stepping into the throws. But that's self-initiated. He did that the next day, and he chose to categorize his picks and look at failure in a way that he could depersonalize it. And that's what you're describing in your journey, you know, like sitting with failure, learning from it, you know, learning to shut out the critics and rely on your instinct to do what was most needed in the moment to continue to grow and learn, right? And I think that's such a beautiful metaphor for any field of excellence, right?
Avoidable picks. I love that. I might use that. The avoidable picks. And again, life is full of patterns that are obvious. And I go back to the word logic. It's logic. Here's your pattern. Here's what you can do. Avoid any kind of hurdle or obstacle or pick. And then you know that one of the reasons that elite athletes, and obviously you were one of the reasons that elite athletes practice so much. People always say, the regular season is too long. There's a reason you have the regular season is long, is so that you get to those moments that become unpredictable and you have that ability, like perhaps I did on 9/11 or whatever other event, that something unforeseen happens, so that you have the armor, the artillery, the preparation skill in you, similar to a CEO in a business when something bad happens and how they react. Because we've seen a lot of CEOs not react. And in this last year, they're all like, what did they hit their head? And that's Peyton Manning, that's the reason why he is one of the goats of the game. Mm. And I'm sure all the great ones have done that. Give themselves that, you know, by having all of the, and having all the misses. Yeah, it's again, cliche, Michael Jordan, all the misses, Wayne Gretzky, all the shots. That's what you do. So that you know when it's unforeseen, you can handle it in the, it might not be the perfect way. It might not be the best way, but it's going to be better than if you had nothing at all. You better have something there in your toolbox.
In a hostile environment when it counts, under pressure, right?
Hostile, whatever, a turning point, turnkey, unpredictable. And I go back, that's just life. I mean, that's if somebody came down the road and they went into the ditch and their car is burst in flames. How would you handle that? Who goes? Who helps? Yeah. You know, and I know but that could happen. How do you react if somebody has a heart attack in front of you? And these, by the way, are bigger questions than sports or business. Has a heart attack. Are you well-versed enough in CPR to be able to help? And will you help? I always look at that. I think, well, you know, I'm glad I got CPR because I want to help. Or are you just one of those people that just walks by?
Yeah.
It's kind of life.
Yeah, exactly. And so, Rod, to close, I want to just share with you Denzel Washington. You know, I love quotes and stories. And Denzel Washington gave a great commencement speech where he talked about the ghosts of unfulfilled potential. And what he said to the graduating class was this idea of at your deathbed, you know, you will be surrounded by ghosts, and they will be ghosts that either are happy that you fulfilled what you were meant to fulfill, or they will be angry and pissed off and bitter because they gave you talents that you didn't act on. And you didn't act on the ideas that you had to reach your potential. And they're angry, bitter, and resentful because they have to go to the grave with you being unsatisfied with your life, right? And it's such a metaphor, right? So when you look back at your own life, and I hope you're blessed with, you know, I hope I can play 18 holes with you at some point in Toronto. I don't know where you're based.
I don't think we're playing in Saudi anytime soon.
Yeah.
But unless I join the Live Golf League,
which is 10 kilometers away. My son was with Brooks when he won last time, and Brooks brought him on the green and gave him a signed ball. But
really?
Anyways, yeah. It's amazing.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. But when you think about your own life and you think about the amazing things you accomplished in looking back at your life, how will you know? And you still have a couple decades, 3 decades, you know, hopefully 92, 95.
I'm on Freedom 95, so right? I better.
But when you look back at your life, how will you know that there are no ghosts of unfulfilled potential when it's your time? Like what evidence will you have of the impact?
Yeah. And, you know, and I guess that I love that. I've seen that from Denzel, and he's a very profound guy. Great beyond being a great actor. I think that he's so right. And that's when it goes back to our last question, talking about ego and how is it not always about you? And I think the greatest lesson I've probably learned along the way is to play it forward, you know, and it's kind of my mantra in life is not just pay it forward, but play it forward. Because I'm clearly not rich enough to pay it forward, but I like to play it forward. And I look at my parents. I lost my parents in the last few years, and my mom was such a firecracker, great lady, just a gregarious person, just the life of every party, laugh, infectious giggle, and surrounded, you know, when she passed, it was like, everybody was so sad, but she just gave so much. And she didn't have like, she didn't do any of the things that, I've been able to do personally in terms of sports and all that. She didn't hardly ever flew. She didn't, all the things that we have been lucky enough as adults to experience, all of it. I'm just not saying myself, everybody. She's kind of from that generation, but all she wanted was for her kids to enjoy and to have her kids surround her. That's where we were. That's when you know those ghosts are happy ghosts. Mm. When that was, she left this world, even though painful, she left this world knowing that that's exactly kind of what her destiny was. That's what she wanted. That's what made her happiest. I would say that's the thing. Whatever makes you happiest. My dad, unfortunately, not as lucky in his final years, suffered from dementia through the pandemic and some disease as well. And, you know, I recall, you know, and he didn't even have a funeral, you know, just because of the circumstances. And his goal was like my mom's, you know, your kids are. And I would look at that as being the way I would not want to go, especially the way my dad went. And you know, if I had to go, and especially not knowing things and all that, I honestly would consider, I've said this before, is that I don't want to be that person. And if I am at that stage, I want to go when I'm happiest, when I'm happy and I understand. Like, how about the people that are passed away and you don't even know if there's a ghost there? My dad had no clue. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't want to go that way. So the ghosts that I would want around me are the fact that, yeah, I like my parents. I want my kids to be so happy. I want my friends to know that they had an opportunity to have fun in our life and share great conversation and laughs and experiences. But I also would like to think that if it passed any kind of legacy on, it would be to play it forward. And I've been involved in a lot of charities through the years, and I don't get involved. It's people, I think I get involved selflessly, but it's probably selfishly just because I get so much out of it. You know, I got so much out of helping Plan Canada, where I've been around the world seeing people, and that gave me a great perspective on sports, seeing people who are suffering and realizing, you know what I do is minuscule. These people they have to survive every day. Special Olympics, you know, being involved with people with intellectual disabilities and knowing that, you know, what are their ghosts going to look like and we'll be around, and they're the happiest, most joyous people. And similar to the people I met in Plan Canada, and then people who are physically disabled with Easter Seals, I do some work and same thing. And people keep saying, why do you do it? I really don't have time, because I get a lot out of it. It gives me purpose as well. I understand what I do in sports. Like, this is not significant, but I think we're put on this planet through whatever force as well, to help people, to make sure that we get a good perspective and to make sure we are able to craft our narrative to say that, hey, we didn't walk by, we didn't not do this, we didn't say thank you, we didn't say please. All of those little things, I think, form the person you become. So at my ghosts, I would hope that they were, I kind of actually hope my ghosts actually would give me some sort of pill that gave me a few more years, but I would hope that they would gather or the people around me, or the younger people in particular, would pass that on to their next generation. Cause it was passed on to me clearly through my parents or the people I've been around, the leaders I've been around. I would hope that they would want to play it forward too.
Well, that's beautiful. And You know, I know that you won the 2013 Queen Elizabeth Diamond Jubilee Medal for your volunteer work, and that must have been very special, and that's evidence of your work. And I really appreciate our time together, you know.
Yeah, you too. It was great.
Yeah, and we have some common connections back in Canada through sport. You know, so I really hope that I can look you up for a round of golf when I'm back Canada with
my
son.
We will do that for sure. We will do that for sure.
Where do you want people to find you on social media? I know it's not hard, but just for the listeners, where can they find you?
For now, I'm on Twitter. It depends on how this X thing goes at Rod Black TV. I think at Rod Black TV is for everything. I will tell you, I got to get better at social media. I like Facebook. I read more about other people. I guess I shouldn't say I'm so busy that I don't. I like to repost great stories about great people and good things. So they can find me there, and I hope to you know probably plant a few more seeds in the social media down the road, but. And be, I guess, a little more social on social media, but I'm not, I like the fact that social media can be this massive garbage dump, but it can also be this great lightning rod. And there are so many great stories out there that people, with the beauty of video, Andy, like there's video for everything, like anything is in video now. And you go, oh, that makes my day. I'd rather watch a video of something making my day than listen to or hear a story about something that was negative. I'd rather, we need more good news in the world. We really do need it. But I look forward to tapping into anybody who comes on, and I look forward to seeing you. Thank you for the conversation. I really good luck running your life, and you're doing it well from afar. And I think that's a great title for your podcast, because I think we all can run our life. We just gotta think about getting better at it every day.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rod. So I'm going to close off the show, and then I just want to say goodbye to you. So thanks for your precious time. I appreciate it. Everybody, thank you very much for listening to this episode with Rod Black, and I hope you come back to listen to future episodes.
You are going to find your place, child. Of that much I know, I'm sure. Keep on laughing at the rain, I guess. Isn't that the place to start? Someday you will be stronger than you are now, but you will not know everything. And when the water's spilling over the bow, you'll still have me in the wind. Gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. Your mother like she's made of gold. After all, she brought you here. And if you're lost, go see the ocean. It will always help you steer. Someday you will be stronger than you are now, but you will not know everything. The water spilling over the bow, you'll still have me in the wings. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. Thank you.
Someday I will be weaker than I am now, and I still won't know everything. When I'm passing up and over the clouds, I hope that you'll have learned from me. Someday you will be stronger than you are now, but you will not know everything. And when the water's spilling over the bow, you'll still have me in the way. Gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. You gotta get up to get down, kid. You gotta get down to get up again. Gotta get up to get down, kid. Hey, you gotta get down to get up.